This is reality proves possibility. We can do better than this. This is Reality Proves Possibility, and we can do better than this. And we're here, and I'm delighted to be here with Stuart Hart, a hero, a pioneer in the field of sustainable business. And thank you so much for being here with us, Stuart.
Oh, absolutely delighted.
There's almost no award that you didn't receive in the field, from the Academy of Management to HBR's top article to many other accolades. But I just wanted to respond to the title of this podcast: "Reality Proves Possibility, and We Can Do Better Than This." What's your take off the cuff?
Well, as you know, when you first invited me, my first reaction is that's a pretty low bar.
Yeah.
So we must do much better than current reality. So we're working off a fairly low base.
Yeah. And in some way, I mean, your career, I think we can speak to probably many people that start their career in going into academia, is like there is a desire, right? We can do better than this. We need to figure that out. What inspired you in your sort of earlier discernment to become an academic to begin with?
Wow. Okay. So we're going back fairly far. Will you indulge me? You know, with
yes,
little...
absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, for that, really, that goes kind of all the way back to the 70s. So I was back in the day, you know, I would have put myself in the environmentalist camp. I did my master's at the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. I don't have an MBA. Upon finishing, I sort of went into what we would probably think of as the NGO world. Kind of at the time, it had a lot to do. It was the early days of the National Environmental Policy Act, and environmental impact statements were like a new thing. And there was a lot of hope around that, right? That these statements, because they would force developers to consider alternatives, which seemed like a really radical thing at the time. But after a couple of years, so I was involved in that sort of area. But after a couple of years of doing that, it became clear that it just had devolved into sort of a legalistic, kind of attempt, because the developers basically didn't really consider alternatives. It was just perfunctory, and they were really looking to pitch their project. And so it turned into essentially an exercise in stopping projects. And I wasn't terribly inspired by that. And I was working with a guy who had a PhD from Yale, and it did his dissertation work on the forest products industry, which seemed like a really radical thing to me at the time, you know, that you would actually study companies rather than trying to stop them. but his work was on strategic decision making, and it got me more and more interested in trying to understand why would such seemingly damaging and destructive decisions be made in the first place. So I got interested in strategy and strategic decision making, ended up going back, did my PhD at Michigan in, you know, what sort of strategy and policy. It was back before business schools were really very business research active. So I did it as an interdepartmental program, you know, although I had some people from the business school involved. The action at the time really was at the Institute for Social Research. And for me, because I was interested in the connection between kind of environment and strategy, the School of Natural Resources and Environment. So I became a known quantity there, and then was at the Institute for Social Research upon finishing my PhD for, you know, 3 years postdoctoral work. Didn't really think, certainly not, you know, when I graduated from Yale, didn't think that I was, the idea of being a professor never really crossed my mind. Mm-hmm. But you sort of increment your way into it, you know. So by the time I finished the PhD, I wasn't really interested in being a faculty member then, right? I was interested more in doing action research. And that's what the Institute for Social Research was aimed at. It was the wellspring of things like participative management, organizational innovation, org psych, you know, at Michigan is very strong. So kind of like participatory management and study of organizations, that was the kind of the deep part of the Institute for Social Research. But it was now the mid-80s, right? And business schools were becoming academic for the first time. I shouldn't say that, but perhaps again, because they were derided as they were back in the 50s and 60s as having just become kind of places that, like teaching mills, you know, with retired executives and accountants and so forth. So business schools became academic, more academic again in the 80s with a big hiring wave of PhD faculty, many of whom were economists, and they eventually took business schools over, as we all know. That's a separate discussion. Mm-hmm. But I'm not an economist. I was a strategy person. So coming at it more from the organizational perspective with a background in kind of environment and so forth. So I got a bunch of job offers, you know, at business schools, and including at Michigan. So I decided to stay since I had a young family. And so I became an assistant professor of strategy at Michigan, you know, just sort of stumbled my way into it and really had absolutely no idea what I was doing when I first got there. You know, I got thrown into teaching the core course in strategy and was more or less clueless at the time. This is like 1985 or 86. So I was in there with another rookie, you know, and the course head was a guy who'd been there 2 years. And we totally cratered it, you know, and so like we just, and the school, even at the time, while it was paying more attention to research than teaching, even then, that was the start of it, right? You couldn't have a core course crater. So they sent the big gun in to clean it up, which was none other than C.K. Prahalad, right, who was kind of a rising star in the strategy area at Michigan at the time. And that's how I got to know CK. That's how I learned how to teach. Mm-hmm. So I got to the point where, you know, I could teach the core course, you know, and, you know, kind of bow to all the various deities out there, you know, teaching the five forces and industry analysis. So I could get decent student evaluation, but I really hated what I was teaching. I mean, I didn't believe what I was teaching. And so kind of reached a point of identity crisis by the late 80s where I wasn't sure I wanted to stay as a business school professor. Mm-hmm. But in 1990, some things happened that kind of changed that prospect, where we had a new dean in the business school and a new dean in the School of Natural Resources and Environment who happened to have come from Yale, who held the first joint chair. There's a chair there still at Yale called the Weyerhaeuser Chair between the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, now the School for the Environment, and the School of Organization and Management. It was a guy named Gary Brewer, and he came as the dean of the School of Natural Resources and Environment, Michigan. And having been a joint chair, his first move was to reach out to the new business school dean. You know, these were like the first boomer deans, right? So they were not that much older than me. Mm. And the new business school dean, a guy named Joe White, was interested in that. And that's what opened the door to creating the dual degree between the two schools. So I jumped through that window, you know, and haven't looked back since, although there were plenty of, you know, kind of detours along the way. That sort of got me, you know, that was in 1990. And I said to myself, I sort of committed, even though most people said it was career suicide, you know, I just committed to myself that this is what I was going to do for the rest of my professional life. And I didn't really care what happened, you know, and I paid my share of costs for it. But I still remember Prahalad saying, like around that same time frame, he was one of the few people that supported it, that, you know, if you don't, you've got this weird background, if you don't, you know, kind of follow your own personal passion in a profession like the one we're in, then why are you in it? You know, you'll look back in 20 or 30 years and you'll never forgive yourself. So, and boy, was that right. You know, there were maybe two or three other kind of business school academics doing anything at that point in time in this area in like 1989, 90. Mm-hmm. And those were Tom Gladwin at NYU and Paul Srivastava, who also was at NYU at the time. And he soon thereafter moved to Bucknell, but it was really those two in the management area. And that was about it.
Mm. And so reality proves possibility. You can shift academia. You can create something in some of the top schools that was leading, right? In some way, the conversation for a long time, unfortunately, you have to say, that is sort of the state. But what do you see the biggest successes of you being there or creating what you were able to create there?
Yeah. So, I mean, I kind of look back on all of that because I left Michigan for a variety of reasons, including being denied tenure. Mm-hmm. But I was denied tenure, but then asked to stay. So I stayed on off the tenure track for 2 or 3 years, directing the new dual degree, which at the time was called the Corporate Environmental Management Program. It was before sustainability was a real term of art. Once you're kicked off the tenure track, there's no expectation you're going to continue to write, right? So there was no pressure, But that's when I wrote everything that put me on the map. You know, so like the piece that came out in AMR, the Academy Management Review, the Natural Resource Based View of the Firm, mm-hmm. and then the piece in Harvard Business Review, Beyond Greening, I wrote during that period after I'd been denied tenure. And then other schools started getting interested in me, and I got tenured offers. So I left. I went to UNC, went to Kenan Flagler with tenure. And they were interested in starting us. We started something called the Center for Sustainable Enterprise. And then from there, I went to Cornell. Sam Johnson endowed a chair and gave an endowment gift to create a center called the Center for Sustainable Global Enterprise. So I went there and built that. And, you know, and it became evident, this was now like 2010 timeframe, that that was as far as they were interested in going at the time. And I, you know, I'm sort of a restless sort, and I could have just stayed, you know, but I had no interest in just repping the same thing over and over again. So I decided to go do phase retirement and go emeritus and move back to Ann Arbor at that point. That was in 2013. And I thought I was done with academia. You know, I had my own little nonprofit consulting firm called Enterprise for a Sustainable World. I was doing a bunch of work with companies, still writing, you know, and that's when, our colleague Sanjay Sharma decided to take the dean job at the University of Vermont. And his intention in going there was to abolish the existing MBA program and start over again with a clean sheet. And he asked me at that once he was successful, it took him a year to orchestrate that. But once that had happened and there was approval to create a new MBA program focused on sustainability, he asked if I'd be interested in getting involved. And so starting in 2013-14 timeframe, I began in earnest on that path. And now having spent the better part of 10 years, you know, kind of working at that, and then I became the, you know, kind of co-director of that program for a period of time, it's become evident to me that is, you know, as important as I think the work has been, you know, at Michigan, UNC, Cornell, creating dual degrees and centers, it's still most of what's happened at business schools to date is what, you know, Sanjay and I wrote a piece about this, you know, like maybe 10 years ago, the title of which was Beyond Saddlebag, Sustainability in Business Education. And I think that's still mostly where we are. In other words, business schools have been very effective at creating saddlebags that hang off the side, you know, centers, institutes, electives, sequences, concentrations, mm-hmm. practicums, and so forth. And I certainly did my share of that at those at Michigan, UNC, and Cornell. And I think you can have really high quality saddlebags. But saddlebags, they still remain, right? And that you can always take the saddlebag off a horse and it's the same old horse. And that's still kind of where we are, right? That mm-hmm. that business education is still largely rooted in the 80s curriculum, you know, sort of the neoliberalist, you know, neoclassical economic shareholder primacy driven MBA. That's still the message that most students take away because that's the core. And the sustainability stuff's an add-on. It's a saddlebag. And so I think what made the Vermont kind of experience interesting was we actually have been able to stand up a completely new program that's a clean sheet redesign of what business education should look like for the 21st century. That starts with a different set of assumptions. It doesn't begin with shareholder primacy and neoliberalism. It starts from a different foundation, which is what's the knowledge, skills, capability, toolkit, values, you know, ethics that business leaders and entrepreneurs and business transformers need in order to transform existing corporations and launch new ones, right? That actually create sustainable and inclusive business.
Mm-hmm. And you've been writing about this for many years. You've worked with companies in this space. Can you share a number of examples that give you hope? You've described the program at Vermont now as one of the programs that probably sort of encapsulates the best at the time of what you could think of. What else do you see out there that gives you hope? What else is there in terms of the corporate space also of that this is possible, this is a possible reality?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm April Hardy, crime victim advocate trained by NOVA, founder of In Case I'm Murdered, and recent recipient of a $12,500 grant for intimate partner homicide prevention work. I've experienced domestic violence from both sides, as the employee whose performance suffered, and as the business owner who absorbed every cost directly. This is the Safe Work Advantage podcast that helps HR professionals and business leaders recognize risk, reduce liability, and protect their people.
Yeah. So, nothing ever stays the same or turns out the way that you expect it will. I think that's just kind of a rule of life. So, part of my motivation for writing this new book, the Beyond Shareholder Primacy book, it became increasingly clear to me, starting maybe 2015, 2016 timeframe, that what we had been doing, that's when I was in the midst of creating the Vermont program, and that's when Sanjay and I wrote the Beyond Saddlebag stuff, that most of what had passed for sustainable business up until that time was almost entirely incrementalist, right? That, and again, just like saddlebags can be high quality, there can be high quality incrementalism. But most of it had been, the piece that I wrote in 1997 that was in Harvard Business Review was entitled Beyond Greening, Strategies for a Sustainable World. And so I drew the distinction between greening and beyond greening. Greening being kind of continuous improvement to existing products and processes, things like waste reduction, eco-efficiency, product stewardship, kind of even life cycle thinking, right? I would put in that category. Whereas beyond greening is the more transformational stuff, right? It's how do we get to next generation, truly sustainable technology, regenerative technology, and how do we harness the power of business to serve and lift the underserved, at the base of the income pyramid? Those are much more transformational strategies. Many of us knew back then, right? In 1997, that's what we were going to need.
Mm.
But yet, you turn the clock forward to 2015 timeframe, and we're still stuck in greening pretty much, and it became increasingly clear that the reason that we were still stuck in greening was because the existing kind of incarnation of capitalism, American style capitalism, as it was began to be practiced in the 80s, just disallowed it, right? It made it almost impossible for business leaders of publicly held companies to do that, right? They were under too much pressure. They wore the golden handcuffs, right? Since agency theory, had tied their comp to share price, and share price was driven by short-termism and quarterly earnings growth, they're sort of on a hamster wheel. And even if they knew that was messed up, if they were kind of stuck, and had lots of interaction with business leaders over that period of time where that was basically the message. And that's pretty frustrating, and so it became increasingly evident that if we were ever going to get anywhere from a truly transformational perspective, then we as business school faculty and professors and researchers, as well as business leaders, had to step up to the challenge of shifting the larger system, that it was the rules of the game of capitalism as it was currently practiced that were the problem and that needed changing. And so that's what sort of set me on the course to writing this new book, because my previous work had been all kind of fit within the paradigm of shareholder value creation, because that was the game, right? Starting in the 80s, if you didn't play that game, then you had no audience, right? You pretty much had to couch sustainability in terms of shareholder value, or else it went nowhere. Most of my work was in that paradigm, like capitalism at the crossroads and so forth, and the sustainable value framework, even the work on kind of serving the base of the pyramid, still kind of was in that for we're trying to shoehorn it into the existing frame. But it became increasingly clear that the frame was the problem, and that's what was holding us back. And so that was my motivation to start on this new book, and that got me deeply into an understanding of history. I'm no history professor, but I've become sort of a closet historian over the last decade or so, and read a lot of history over that period of time. And first third of the book is essentially history, kind of looking back, over the last 500 years. And what became evident to me was, while capitalism has a source code kind of rooted in exploitation, namely mercantilism, right? It's been pulled back on multiple occasions. It hasn't always been that way. There have been periods where capitalism has, the rough edges have been rounded out for a period of time, where it's been pulled back from its own, from the brink of its own self-destruction. Starting, with the American experiment, with the American Revolution and the founding of the Republic, which really put corporations back in a fairly carefully controlled box for the better part of a half a century until they were out again, right? And then we get the Gilded Age and the Industrial Revolution and so forth. But then we have the advent of the Progressive Era and the New Deal and FDR and so forth. And that that's, you know, sort of seriously changed the practice of capitalism, you know, to think more in terms of building a middle class and being community oriented, even though there were plenty of blind spots like, you know, environment and women and minorities. You know, there's plenty of blind spots in the 50s and 60s when I grew up. And that's what a lot of the rebellion was about. But the fact remains that those corporations were rewarded for creating, you know, creating promotion ladders and middle class pay and building the middle class and, you know, being good community citizens, whether or not that meant something different back then than the way we think about it now. But the fact, you know, that they were run that way and the middle class was built that way, right? And there are lots of other, you know, circumstances that enabled that. But the point that I took away from all of that sort of historical understanding was there's nothing kind of permanent or preordained with the way that capitalism has been run, you know, at least American style capitalism since the 80s. That's a product of the, you know, Chicago School of Economics, you know, kind of perpetrating a myth on people, most of which, you know, has since been debunked or disproven. So there's really no underlying kind of truth to much of those assumptions around things like, you know, homo economicus and the whole root of agency theory based on people behaving that way, you know, kind of selfishly greedy, you know, and out for themselves and not don't have the interests of the company in mind. So, I mean, most of those assumptions have been debunked, you know, through behaviorally not economics and in other through other ways. So there's really not much left underneath the scaffolding that built shareholder primacy, but yet it persists. So, but it became evident to me that even that, you know, was a relatively recent, you know, sort of metastasized version of neoclassical economics, and that there's nothing permanent about it. It's just simply a story. It's a myth. It's a narrative. And it's within our power to change that myth and narrative, and that's the real challenge that we face. So that's the message of my book, right? And so I'm heartened by the fact that I think we see that reality now being realized more and more. And so there's more and more work being done around the idea of the role of business in altering, in changing, in reforming the rules of the game and the larger system itself, you know, and all of the talk about system change investing and shareholder commons, you know, and long-term stock exchange. And, you know, we can go on and more companies, you know, starting with the Unilevers and so forth, stepping out to try to take action at that level. And that's a big part of my new book as well. You know, so how as business leaders can we think about taking action at the larger system level that will enable us to pull our own strategies for sustainability through much more effectively, because it's the systemic constraints that hold us back. So I'm heartened by that, right? And I talk about a few company examples in the book, you know, companies I've worked with, you know, like Griffith Foods and Novellus and a few others that, you know, Trane Technologies, some others that are maybe not the usual suspects that I think are interesting cases where they're on a path toward thinking this way.
Wonderful. Do you mind giving us maybe one or two examples of companies or maybe also leaders, persons, people that give you hope, where you maybe that people can use to look at this shift of a narrative in business specifically and what it.
Yeah. And perhaps another kind of realization that probably should be obvious in retrospect, but it took a while for it to kind of wear through my thick head. that most of the companies that I think are doing the most interesting things are not large publicly held corporations. You know, like the Novellus case, which was a result of a demerger of Alcan, which landed on the New York Stock Exchange for a period of time, but then got taken, was bought by the Aditya Birla Group in India, and they were willing to commit longer term patient capital they invested in a longer term strategy of becoming the world's first above ground aluminum company, you know, where their goal was to really minimize, you can't eliminate entirely, but to minimize the use of prime aluminum, you know, to basically become above ground miners. And then, you know, one of the other kind of living cases in the book is a company called Griffith Foods, which is a privately held, you know, fourth generation family company. It's a global company, 1.5 billion revenue kind of global company in the food space, but it's privately held and it's, you know, it's family run. And, you know, And I talk about that company at length because a lot of my thinking about the, this sort of distinguishing between or among, most publicly held companies today, although even this is what I'm about to say is under assault at some level, have sustainability goals, right? Which would typically include, now we have the language of scope 1, 2, and 3. And if you look at, you know, if you look carefully at those sustainability goals for companies, most of them are scope 1 and 2. And then they'll have a, you know, a 2050 net zero goal, which is scope 3, kind of a, like a post-it note on the wall to the future. But most of the goals are scope 1 and 2, you know, where they have more direct control. And that those can include, you know, kind of facility operations, you know, like energy use and water use, but it could also be HR oriented, like DEI, right, and so forth, which is, you know, DEI tragically has been defined, you know, as mainly an internal HR thing, when my own way of thinking about DEI is, what does the company do in the world? I mean, I think that's the more important aspect of diversity, equity, and inclusion. But so, you know, I think the thinking, because the thinking had been so constrained to within the four walls, so most companies have such goals, and then most companies have a statement of societal purpose, right, that has become sort of expected over the last, you know, 10, 15, 20 years, that companies, large companies especially, develop a societal purpose statement. Whereas I'm old enough to remember, like, back in the 80s, I started teaching executive education at Michigan in the late 80s. And the thing then was, you know, kind of corporate vision and mission. And vision and mission back then was generally a competitive mission. It meant, you know, we're going to surround and kill the competition and dominate the market and so forth. But that fell out of favor, you know. And over the last decade or so, you know, purpose replaced the idea of vision and mission. And the purpose necessarily had to have a kind of a societal contribution flavor to it. So most, you know, corporations now have such purpose statements, and I don't mean to deride them. I mean, I think it's great that, and, you know, and a lot of them are serious about it, right? That they went through a process internally. They, in many cases, involved a lot of people in the company in crafting them. So they're not just, you know, they're not throwaways, but on the other hand, they do sort of dangle there, right? They're on the corporate website often. And then there's the sustainability goals, but never the twain shall meet, right? There's no real connection between the kind of scope one, you know, water use and energy use and DEI, and a statement of corporate purpose about how we're going to change the world. How do those things connect, right? And so as being a strategy guy, you know, I sort of look under the hood and fail to really see how those things connect, right? Like, where's the connection in terms of the core process, business processes of the company, you know, like the resource allocation process, the capital investment process, the long-range planning process, the operating process, and so forth, right? All companies have such processes. But if there's no real connection between the statement of societal purpose and the sustainability goals, then what is it really, right? So that's where the work with Griffith Foods, I think, took on such significant importance, because we were able to kind of articulate the difference between what I think of now as foundational or functional sustainability goals. And those are the scope 1 and 2 goals that you can typically assign accountability to functional leadership in the company, you know, like operations people or procurement people or HR people or even R&D people, right? When it comes to investing in new technologies, doing the R&D to acquire or M&A, right, to acquire kind of new capabilities. But none of those things are connected directly to business. So second category I talk about in the book are business aspirations, sustainability-driven business aspirations, because sustainability can't really be part of what the company's about unless, you know, unless sustainability infuses the company's business aspirations. And it can't be a business aspiration unless there's revenue and profit attached to it. So, you know, most sustainability goals don't have any business connection. They are measuring directly things like, you know, energy use and water use and hiring practices in the company, all of which are important, but they're foundational, they're functional, they're foundational, they're not business aspirations. And so there's another level, which is kind of business aspirations, which typically has to be scope 3. It has to entail, you know, the whole value chain of the company and include, you know, kind of revenue and profit goals, as well as kind of impact goals. Those things have to be integrated, or else it's not a business aspiration. But then even above and beyond that would be the more system change oriented stuff, right? For the company to really draw its business aspirations forward in a productive way. Sometimes there are systemic constraints, you know, whatever they might be in a given industry or a given company, in which case the company needs to step out and assume a leadership role in creating the partnership ecosystems at a more system level. So I call that corporate quest.
Mm-hmm.
And that so the architecture for the company becomes foundational goals, business aspirations, and corporate quest. And Griffith, you know, the relationship with Griffith Food and with Brian Griffith and the others, you know, kind of senior people there and a lot of people in the company, that's where that company is headed. And it's quite exciting because it's privately held, it's family run. Brian has also experimented with, you know, a different governance structure where there's a board, but there's also a sustainability advisory group. And then there's the kind of the senior level people in the company, both functional as well as business leadership, that are all involved in the governance system of the company, and they interact with each other. And so the board's not a conventional board where it's about monitoring and compliance and so forth. It's a future-oriented board. The board, the role of this kind of group is to help the company future. And that's the purpose of it. So that it's been really interesting and I think exciting and hopeful to kind of see all of that unfold.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Sarah Beth Herman, a 5-time CEO and host of the podcast No Silver Spoons. This show is for leaders, entrepreneurs, and people building something meaningful without shortcuts. We talk about leadership, mindset, business growth, and the real lessons that come from doing hard things really well. And if you're in the dental industry, you'll hear a few episodes that speak directly to that world too. Because no matter your field, leadership is leadership. Listen to No Silver Spoons wherever you get your podcasts.
Wonderful, wonderful. And maybe you can share with us also a little bit some of the initiatives that are sort of maybe emanating from this engagement, but also I believe you've mentioned this before, that some of the work that you're doing is with family-owned businesses that are in a certain sort of capital region where they have global reach and impact, that they benefit from the structure and the governance possibilities that you just outlined. Can you share a little bit more?
Absolutely, yeah. So kind of an outgrowth of all this, you know, of these kinds of companies, you know, sort of the realization that it, you know, it's often been the privately held companies, the family companies that are doing the most interesting and exciting things, you know, and at least in part, that's because they're not subject to Wall Street's, you know, kind of golden handcuff rules. They can choose to behave in a different way. I mean, so can leaders of publicly held companies, but they have to be willing to pay the price, which typically means activists come in and fire them.
Mm.
Whereas, you know, privately held firms, even in the private equity world, you know, where they may have a reputation of just having been raiders, even in the private equity world, you see the beginnings of change, you know, where because they're not, you know, by definition, it's private equity, they have agency to behave in ways they think are appropriate or that make sense. But for the privately held companies, that's really where the leverage is, you know, but yet most attention in the sustainable business world, as myself included, for the last 30 plus years, has been focused on either the large global publicly held companies and sort of, you know, kind of banging on them. And what we've ended up with mostly is incrementalism for all the reasons I just talked about. Or else the other extreme, you know, which is the tiny B Corp world. And I don't mean to diminish or deride either. Both of those are important, right? They're both important. But the, you know, the B Corp world is mostly really small companies that, and they, in that sense, they don't really move the needle. I think they're interesting. And I've worked with a bunch of them. I think they're doing well, but they don't really move the needle. And so that sort of led to the realization that, well, maybe we're sort of missing what is really the guts of the economy. And so over the last couple of years, I've worked with such a business leader. It's a guy named Fred Keller, who was a founder of such a company. Company is Cascade Engineering, based in Grand Rapids. And he's run the company with great vision for the last 30 or 40 years. I had his daughter as an MBA student at Cornell, and she's now the CEO, and she did the Sustainable Enterprise Tracker. Mm-hmm. Fred, you know, he's been practicing this forever, right? This is just who he is, both on the social side as well as the environmental side. And so he and I over the last couple of years have been trying to stand up this initiative. And we have a little company we've created called Internality. You know, the kind of the core premise is that we need to fundamentally rethink the whole concept of externality. That, you know, the thinking about externalities is a century old, you know, going back to the days of Arthur Pigou and so forth and Marshall. And that thinking was kind of rooted in what the way externalities existed or were thought of, you know, 100 years ago plus, which were mostly industrial age, you know, muddy streets and belching smokestacks and unsafe workplaces and so forth. So it was all what we would think of today as scope one and two. Well, we kind of know how to get after scope one and two. That's no longer really the problem. The problem is that externalities have metastasized in scale and scope. They're no longer just local, noxious kinds of unsafe things. They're regional, they're national, they're global in scope, and they interact, you know? So it's deforestation, it's climate change, it's species loss, it's inequality and so forth. And these things are connected to each other. And you can't really pin it on individual companies and try to find, you know, either find them or, you know, according to the theory of the old days of environmental economics, well, we can, you know, put a price on it or, you know, make tradable permit. Well, you know, it just doesn't really work because these issues, you know, go beyond national boundaries, they're global in scope and they're interconnected. So we have to think, we have to get after this in a fundamentally different way. And our conclusion is it's probably got to be the business world itself that really takes this on. And what's the most likely place that could come from? Well, it's probably going to be the privately held companies that have the agency to really take it on and think this way. And so it became, you know, sort of maybe painfully obvious at some point. Once you begin to dig into it, you realize that in the United States, of those companies, those corporations that earn more than $100 million a year in revenue, that 90% of them are privately held, and that they create 80% of the jobs. But yet they don't really have a voice, right? They're sort of unseen in many ways. And so our initiative, you know, which we started calling Bringing the World Inside, you know, or, you know, kind of the idea of internality, is geared around trying to build a community of those business leaders and to both to share innovations with the kind of Griffith Foods and Cascade Engineerings of the world. You know, our hypothesis is that there are a lot of Fred Kellers and Brian Griffiths out there that don't know each other. And they should, for several reasons. One, they can learn a lot from each other. And two, if they put their heads together, they can co-create innovative approaches to get after these problems for the future. Mm-hmm. And three, if we can build that kind of community, these companies are big enough. Griffith Foods is $1.5 billion in revenue. If you combine forces, if there are hundreds of them or thousands of them, and they can speak with a voice, they can bring influence, right? They can bring influence at the system level, which I think, you know, B Corps have just been too small to do. You know, they're not ExxonMobil. They don't have an army of lobbyists. But if they were able to join forces in a significant way, they could bring influence, which is, I mean, obviously most of us would probably say the best thing that could happen would be to get money out of politics. But for the moment, money's in politics. And if that's the case, then we have to figure out how do we contend with the direction that it's going right now. And so this is one way, I think, right, to kind of bring the voice of the mid-tier and those leaders that have the capacity and agency to really think about these problems in new ways.
Wonderful. And that's hopeful in a sense that that is actually something that they can do and have done. And also there, many of the family businesses are a case in point that you can have long-term thinking. You must have long-term thinking, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and that many more, if we can build this initiative right, that we could attract more and more kind of business leaders who are, you know, they wouldn't consider themselves to be sustainability champions, but they are worried about things like, you know, the legacy of the company. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, there's the silver tsunami, that we got a lot of boomer aged kind of business, privately owned family business leaders that want the company to continue on. They don't want to have to sell it to private equity. Mm-hmm. You know? Or shut it down. And so the question is how to do that most effectively. And I think a movement like this could be beneficial in helping to create that kind of momentum as well.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, thank you so much. And there's so much more to unpack and so much hope even that's generated for me right now in terms of ideas and who to connect with whom. And so I'll talk to you offline about it. But I wanted to just end the conversation with just something private about you, in a sense that maybe you can share, like, who are some of the people that you look up to when you're sort of dispirited? Who gives you hope? And then I'm asking you to give me a number from 1 to 35. I'm going to give you the question from Marcel Proust's questionnaire.
You know, I mean, in many ways, I mean, I'll have to say that I've been most inspired by history. You know, we know there's a set of usual suspects that we're all familiar with in the present.
Mm-hmm.
That are doing the good work, you know, trying to move the needle, trying to make things happen. But in some ways, I find most inspiring examples from history of people who, you know, were actually able to achieve it, right? That mm-hmm. were able to pull it off, and that there can be lessons learned from some of those people in terms of how they thought, kind of what sort of approach they took, you know, how they were able to convince others and so forth. So one person I'm quite inspired by is Louis Brandeis,
mm-hmm.
You know, and have read a lot of Louis Brandeis, you know, so I would encourage people to, I mean, if you're, you can get a start on it by checking out my book, because the first third of it is history, sort of understanding how capitalism has evolved and who some of the key players have been in these periods, what I call capitalist reformations, when it's been pulled back mm-hmm. from its excesses. And so I'm quite inspired by those kinds of historical figures, because you can see the whole story then, whereas it's harder now because we're kind of up against it, right? Because you don't really know. So that would be a recommendation I would make.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true also in terms of, because, you know, as you know, Michael, you're in the midst of this, the absolute need to reimagine business education.
Yeah.
That, you know, this isn't the first time that business education has needed to be reimagined, and it has been reimagined before. And so we can find similar, you know, kind of figures in history that were able to have a significant impact that way, and sort of reimagining and shifting the whole name of the game and, you know, how business education is committed, because it's happened before.
Yeah. Wonderful. Now a number from 1 to 35.
16.
Let me see. When and where were you the happiest?
You know, I think in a lot of ways, I'd probably say those days, you know, kind of went as I was at the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, and shortly thereafter, where, you know, you sort of feel like you can do anything at that point. And I'll never forget it, because my wife and I was married at the time. And we decided that I wasn't going to just try to get a job immediately. So we decided to just go and travel the country for however long we were going to travel the country. And we did that, right? So, you know, I graduated like in May, and then we were just gone until the fall, right? We just, and I'll never forget at the graduation, there was a guy, the acting dean of the school at Yale, the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at the time, was a guy named Garth Voigt, who actually, and he taught the soils course. I took the soils course from Garth Voigt, and he was actually a student of Aldo Leopold's at the University of Wisconsin. So it goes, you know, there's mm-hmm. that sort of lineage, you know, kind of. And I'll never, he was asking me, you know, at the graduation what I was going to do. And I told him, this is what, you know, Patty, my wife, and I were going to do. And he said, wow, am I ever jealous, you know, like that. He said, I sure wish I did something like, because he said, you know, you'll look back, you know, years from now, and you'll say, boy, am I glad I did that. And boy, was he right. You know, it's like, because when I've never had another opportunity to even imagine doing anything like that, even though I probably could have, right? But I've not done anything remotely resembling that since then.
That's wonderful. That's great to end on that happiest note, in a sense, because that's, I think, what we thrive on and what we want more of in life. And I really thank you for just sharing your thoughts on the realities that you see and the possibilities that you see and that you write about and you're committed to. And I really appreciate your time here and being with me and with the others. So thanks so much, Stu.
My honor, Michael. Thank you.
Thank you.